Hi everyone, I'm Gary Knoll. Always nice to be able to share this hour with you. I promise you this is going to be a different hour. Of course, we're going to begin with the latest on health and healing, always from major centers and articles published in PubMed. For example, how many of you who have migraines also suffer from vitamin deficiencies? Children's Hospital in Cincinnati has something to share about that and what we can do about it. I'm into solutions. So hopefully, by the time you hear these health reports, you'll understand how you can overcome a lot of conditions. For example, how about I'm going to share how you can kill colon cancer stem cells. Penn State University's guiding us on that one today in a new study, and how meditation and yoga can reverse DNA reactions which cause stress. Coventry University in the United Kingdom. And also we'll talk about how glutamine, very important for leaky gut syndrome, suppresses herpes. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. So we have a lot to share, but it's the second part of the program I think you'll find most interesting, because I'm going to address the cancel culture in a way that might surprise you. I'm going to show them a person who was an object of cancel and ridicule and attacks in his own time. But today, virtually everything in our life is made easier because of him. Nikola Tesla, in my opinion, one of the most important minds in the history of civilization. We'll know more about him after today's program than, unless you're a scholar, that you would have ever known, and why it's relevant to the cancel culture. But also my guest today will be Dr. Elizabeth Mumper, M-U-M-P-E-R. Now here's what's interesting. She is a mainstream, ultra-Orthodox, pro-vaccine, top academic and clinical pediatrician. She's the one giving your children all these vaccines over these years. She teaches pediatricians their trade. And yet, I think you'll find what she has to say about the COVID vaccine of interest. And by the way, tomorrow, I'll be revealing something none of you are aware of, unless you're really doing your homework, concerning the backstory of COVID. We finally opened some doors that we believe the public needs to hear. That's tomorrow. And then today, I'm going to have in the final part of our program a singer who just passed, just last week, in her mid-80s. Now, you probably have never heard of her, unless you're into music. Well, I've written several books on the history of film, and Miles Kruger, arguably one of Hollywood's greatest scholars on Hollywood, and I were very close friends. We both lived on the Upper West Side, and when I was writing Black Hollywood, he would come over all the time because he was interested in sitting in on the interviews. And we had many, many interesting debates. And he mentioned once, did I watch Singing in the Rain? I said, of course. I love that film. I love the dancing, love the upbeat personalities. But you know, there's a scene in there, and all of you who've watched Singing in the Rain will recognize this, where the leading actress can't sing at all. Terrible voice. And behind the curtain, actually dubbing her voice, is Debbie Reynolds. And then they pull the curtain back and show Debbie Reynolds and show the other woman couldn't sing. Well, there was a real woman, and this is the woman. Her name was Marnie, M-A-R-N-I, Nixon. And she was the voice of all these celebrities, Audrey Hepburn and My Fair Lady, and Marilyn Monroe's voice. Now imagine having the skill not just to sing, but sing in the same type of vocal registry that the person speaks in. So you couldn't tell the person singing wasn't singing. That's how much of a master she was. She did this in film after film after film. So there's a little tribute to her. And so I'm going to play that. Just something different and something to acknowledge all of the wonderfully creative people that we've had the benefit of having in our lives. That's our program today. So let's begin with the latest on health and healing. And a high percentage, according to Cincinnati Children's Hospital, of children and teenagers, young adults, with migraines appear to have deficiencies of vitamin D, riboflavin, coenzyme Q10, which is a vitamin-like substance found in every cell in the body that's used to produce energy for cell growth and maintenance. Now, these deficiencies also can cause migraines. And up until this point, people weren't always aware what caused the migraines. And this now gives us better insight. So if you have a young person in your life, let's say someone under 20, and they're having migraines, check their vitamin B1, 2, and 6, coenzyme Q10, and folic acid, and vitamin D levels. Get them up to normal. Give them a good supplement or higher potency supplement and see if that doesn't impact. Now, if you as an adult have them, look at vitamin B3 helping you, the non-flush niacinamide. That can help. We all should be concerned about cancer because I'm sure it's taken or impacted virtually someone in your life. In my family, it was my mother, my father, my older brother, and half my aunts and uncles. Well, there's one more thing to add to our positive input. Pennsylvania State University did some research, and they found a compound in grapes that can kill colon cancer stem cells, both in the petri dish but also in mice. The compound, you've heard me mention many times, resveratrol, R-E-S-V-E-R-A-T-R-O-L, three syllables, which are found in grape skins and grape seeds. And it's easy to purchase, inexpensive, just resveratrol. And it could also eventually lead to treatments to help prevent colon cancer. Colorectal cancer, by the way, is the second leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the United States. So I would suggest a combination of resveratrol and grapeseed extract together. I believe that that would be a ticket for prevention and also helping kill the colon cancer cells. This was published in the BMC's Complementary and Alternative Medicine Peer Review Journal. Also from Coventry University in Great Britain, publishing an article on Frontiers in Immunology, meditation and yoga can reverse DNA reactions which cause stress. So this is one of those mind-body interventions. And Tai Chi also is very important in that. And Qigong will work as well. And they simply don't relax us. They can actually, according to this brand new study, reverse the molecular reactions of our DNA which cause ill health and depression. The research is published just today in the Journal of Frontiers in Immunology, and it reviews decades of studies analyzing how the behavior of our genes is affected by different body-mind interventions. So they looked at 18 studies over 11 years, and they found actual molecular changes. So just imagine those in the skeptic community, the people who have total control over Wikipedia. And by the way, there's a brand new book that just shreds Wikipedia. I'm having the author on next week. In any case, in my last study group, I wanted it to last only 2 weeks. Before, it was 2 months on campus. So the question is it possible, merely a hypothesis, is it possible with three positive studies, all within the last year and a half, with high degrees of positive changes in the aging and hard aging, meaning that what you can actually measure in the blood, could you do it in a shorter period of time? And I found the only way I could do it is by changing the protocol by adding what we're now looking at in this study, and that is looking at body-mind interventions, what are called BMIs, like meditation, more of it, like yoga, more of it, and journal writing and drumming and listening to soothing music and quiet time in nature. So that was the huge change in the protocol, and we had huge changes in the outcome, all beneficial. So now I'm going to do a two-week retreat at the end of September where the entire retreat is based upon mind-body interventions to help people with depression, anxiety, and clarification of principles of living. So I'm glad to see that this study was out there. Didn't know this study existed before I did my study, but this is just out today. So I'll be adding, I'm submitting almost three different articles to peer-reviewed journals on my experiences, but now I'm just going to do one just on meditation and yoga, tai chi, qigong, all the different energy works. Everything's on energy. See what the outcome will be. But at least we have a predecessor to that saying yes. Glutamine can suppress reaction of herpes simplex in guinea pigs, mice. This was published in the Journal of Clinical Investigation. It was done at the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. And so this is very important for people who have herpes and it can cause recurrent outbreaks of cold sores and genital sores in humans. Although antiviral medication can help shorten outbreaks, the virus persists. Now, are there therapies that can eliminate? Yes, there are, but none of this is within the mainstream protocols, ozone and high-dose vitamin C, because we've done that many times at the Tri-State Healing Center. But now they're saying that glutamine can also block this process. That's good news. Just something to consider. And finally, from St. George University of London, a new study shows cannabis kills leukemia cells. What did we learn from yesterday's program? Well, we learned from a group of scientists, including the one who was one of the developers of the RNA science that allowed the vaccine to be created, an ultra-Orthodox doctor working with the FDA, etc. But you heard him say on this program that they're now finding that the COVID vaccine RNA does not stay in the shoulder muscle. It spreads throughout the body. That's contributing and going to the brain also, passing the blood-brain barrier. It's causing all forms of problems in the brain and blood clots and thrombosis, etc. But he also said three things yesterday. One, they're finding it in the ovaries. And that's one of the reasons that there's a belief that there's a high percentage of women who've been vaccinated who are now having miscarriages. Two, that it's being found in the bone marrow. That's really bad because now you could have bone cancer and leukemias, and it's being found in the lymph nodes. And that you don't want that in the lymph nodes, lymphatic system, and that could lead to all forms of lymph-related diseases. Three different characteristics that they said couldn't happen. Oh, and also it's shedding. Do you remember the big controversy about 4 months ago where we had reported on the doctor who has spent 40 years developing vaccines, and he said his big concern was what if, it was a hypothesis, what if this sheds? Oh, that's quackery, that's nonsense. And boy, they attacked him. Everyone attacked him. We didn't. We said he merely projected a hypothesis that should be open for discussion. Well, he was right. It is shedding. Now some airlines in other countries are suggesting people who have been vaccinated to reconsider flying, because now we're seeing that contrary to the entire official version, the vaccinated could be the ones who represent the greatest danger to the non-vaccine individuals. And the death count just keeps going up. By the way, also on yesterday's program, I listed all the deaths from the Revolutionary War, the Spanish-American War, the War of 1812, all of the different wars right up to current time. And already the death count from this, the actual death count, and now it's between, I've heard figures of top scientists and epidemiologists, anywhere from 25,000 to 50,000 actually dead in the United States, and millions injured. So we are right now, if their figures are accurate, this vaccine has killed more Americans than battle casualties in the Vietnam War. That's something to think about. So, good news, cannabis kills leukemia cells. A new study has confirmed yet another positive use of cannabis. And cannabis has long been known as having the ability to kill cancer. But the new revelation regarding leukemia is important because the disease is a cancer of bone marrow and of other blood-forming organs. So that's good news. And everything that's good, we're going to share with you. We are 16 minutes into our program. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go to our guest in just a moment, Dr. Elizabeth Mumper, a very orthodox person, ultra-orthodox. But let's see what she has to say that breaks ranks with some of her colleagues. And now to my guest to discuss the threats of the COVID vaccine in children, Dr. Elizabeth Mumper, M-U-M-P-E-R. She's in Virginia. She's a board-certified pediatrician. She's also president and CEO of Rimlin Center in Virginia that mentors medical practitioners and clinicians working with children with neurodevelopmental problems. She also runs a general pediatric practice, Advocates for Children, and her Advocates for Families practice is devoted to caring for autistic children and those with learning disabilities. She's received many awards for her work with children, including Public Service Award from the National Press Club and being named Woman of the Year by the YMCA. In her earlier medical career, she was medical director of the Autism Research Center. And she has many degrees. She's well qualified in the field. In fact, she served as the chief resident of pediatrics at the University of Virginia. She's traveled worldwide, and we're happy to have her on today. And her website is rimlandcenter.com. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
I'd like to begin with a broader question about the trends of vaccine-injured children in general. We've seen the increase in neurodevelopmental and learning disabilities steadily increase in parallel with the increase in the number of vaccines added to the CDC's childhood vaccine schedule. Parents and teachers readily see these problems and have made the association. But the dominant medical establishment, including the majority of pediatric professionals, fail to do so. In fact, they expressly deny a vaccine-autism neurodevelopmental relationship. Yet when pediatricians speak out, they are often ridiculed, and in worst cases, their licenses are threatened. There was a gentleman who was a board-certified pediatrician. His name was Linton Smith, and he was one of the very first, along with, at the very same time, a Dr. Robert Mendelson. Mendelson was in Illinois. And both were succeeding in helping children with problems, but they also were pro-vaccine, but only to the degree that a vaccine could be shown to have been developed using real placebo in a long-term study and therefore the precautionary principle. They were both attacked. Lyndon Smith at one time lost his license. I went to bat for him. This is back in the early 1970s. And he was a best-selling author, never hurt a child, helped children, and yet it sent up a message. If some of the best and brightest in a profession who had the courage to show how children should be helped is discredited, what does it say for lesser people who do not have the same character to stand up? A whole profession could be cowered. I believe that we're seeing some of that now. Would you address this, please, and also the kind of studies that should be conducted that are not being performed, and yet the CDC, the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Service, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease all claim that all vaccines currently in the schedule are safe and effective. The forum is yours.
So, Gary, I have a very personal experience with this issue. I was the director of pediatric education in a residency program when I gave a 15-month-old African-American boy an MMR vaccine as was appropriate for the CDC schedule. And then I watched in horror as he regressed with copious diarrhea and loss of his developmental milestones. And he became autistic. He is virtually nonverbal today, and I still take care of him. I told the parents I thought the shots engendered this horrible reaction in him and that I had done it, and I felt very guilty about that. So that was my personal impetus to take on this issue. And I do give vaccines in my practice, but I do it on a modified schedule. I spend $87,000 a year buying these vaccines. And so for people to say that I am anti-vaccine is, I think, very unfair. But there are several issues. One is that nothing that we do in medicine is 100% safe for every person. So the idea that we have this one-size-fits-all vaccine schedule that is sacrosanct is just not making sense to me. And when you look at what the CDC publishes, it's a recommended schedule. And for people to be persecuted or have their licenses taken away because they deviate from that schedule, because they're taking their individual patients' needs into account, I think is very, very wrong. So I have personally asked the CDC and the NIH and the American Academy of Pediatrics to do more studies looking at vaccinated versus unvaccinated populations. And their argument is always that it would be unethical to deny vaccines to certain people. And that if we just study people who choose not to vaccinate, like people who, for example, homeschoolers have a lower rate of vaccination. But if you look at them, they also have kids that are healthier. So some of us have taken it on to look at our own practices. I collected 15 years worth of data. I have a colleague named Paul Thomas who collected 10 years of data, published a very compelling paper that looked at prevalence of diagnoses of chronic illness in kids according to their vaccination status. And the bottom line was that his very highly vaccinated kids following the CDC schedule did have more chronic illnesses, things like asthma, allergies, neurodevelopmental problems, speech problems, ADHD. And in reliving the same experience from Dr. Smith in the 70s, within 5 days of him publishing that paper, his license was emergently revoked. And I am working with his lawyers to try to help him get his license back. My rate of autism in my practice is about 1 in 260 kids, which is still, you know, one too many, but much better than the current rates in this country, which is about 1 kid in 36 to 1 kid in 50 having autism. So vaccines may be fine for even the vast majority of patients. I think we don't know the science on that for sure. But there are certainly, you know, subsets of kids who have bad vaccine reactions. And we're not just talking a little fever or soreness on the arm. We are talking kids who have neurodevelopmental or immune dysregulation or development of conditions that are going to affect them for at least the foreseeable future. So I think vaccines get more credit than they deserve. If you actually look at when the vaccines were invented compared to when many of the vaccine-preventable diseases were declining, we really should give most of the credit to public health measures and civil engineers who developed things like, you know, sanitation systems and indoor plumbing. And most vaccine-preventable diseases were well on the decline before we had vaccines. So Robert Mendelsohn is one of my heroes. He also wrote a great book, and he did have an academic position for quite a while. But he looked at the patient before him and thought that we should really take care of each and every kid, not make sweeping judgments about one size fits all vaccines that we're going to do come hell or high water for every single kid. Does that make sense?
It certainly makes sense, and I appreciate your insights. I try to take a broad look at any topic. I never start off looking at a topic with any predetermined conclusion. I allow my research to be my conclusion, wherever the evidence falls, and that's it. I don't use politics, ideology. I don't use any other identifying factor except what is the truth, period. And I took 2 years of my life to study every single scientific study in the world that was in, at least that I could read in English, that showed how many children were adversely affected. And just in the United States, you're talking about more than 10 million children in the last 40 years. I'm talking about those with some form of developmental illness or those with some form of non-pre-existing autoimmune condition that later after vaccines developed were taken. Then I take into account the children, and now we're looking at nearly 30 million Americans who you could legitimately say have had some adverse reaction to vaccines. However, according to the CDC, according to the FDA and the mainstream media, none of these 30 million Americans are legitimate. They don't count. They're virtually invisible. And because it's not brought to anyone's attention, well, as long as you decide not to cover a story, then the story has no relevance. So that's why today I'm very concerned, and I would like your input, please, when they're mandating vaccines for all children, no matter what their condition. If they have some autoimmune condition, doesn't matter. If they have cancer, doesn't matter. Everyone should be vaccinated. That's according to Bill Gates, you know, the MD, PhD, scientist, Nobel Prize winner. Oh, no. No. You mean the dancing clown adulterer? Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Someone of great character we should absolutely believe and trust in. And what they are doing now is they're saying they need to get the spike protein. And I'm saying, but virtually all of the peer-reviewed independent literature and all the scientists who are legitimate MD, PhDs, and many are MD, PhDs within one, are saying if you've been infected, then you don't need a vaccine because you now have natural immunity, natural antibody production. And in fact, the latest study, and I'm going to be reporting on this just in a bit, shows that by being vaccinated on top of having natural immunity, it could compound the situation. I won't go into the chemistry of that, but I'll just briefly say they told us that the vaccine would only be in your arm and stay there. Not true. They also said that we shouldn't be concerned about the spike protein, but we should be. In fact, right now, clinical trials are underway to test the COVID vaccines on children, some as young as several months of age. And at the same time, studies are showing that children have a natural immunity, not being infected, just a natural immunity. And therefore, the statistical significance of them dying from COVID is zero. In fact, if you look at the, and that is a fact. So why in the world would you put at risk a large number of children, millions of children under the age of 18, with what is an experimental vaccine that has never been fully tested in either adults, children, or animals? And even the ferret studies they did showed that the ferrets didn't die when they were vaccinated, but later when they came in contact with the wild virus, they all died. And right now we're looking at over 6,000 confirmed deaths by the Vaccine Adverse Reporting System. And a Harvard study showed that that could be 1-2%, and that means 98-99% not reported since it's voluntary. So realistically, and some are actually saying this, including the well-known Dr. McCullough, has said that he believes at this moment, as do a large group of physicians he works with in clinical practice, that we could actually have closer to 50,000 deaths if you looked at real numbers, and you have all these adverse effects, including things we've never seen before. And so why would you put that into a child? Could you address that, please?
Well, Gary, I am going to spend what's left of my career arguing that it's a horrible idea. So let's look at what was done. They basically took a synthetic, meaning man-made, messenger RNA. They wrapped it up in a fatty layer. They're trying to trick our human cells to make these spike proteins. And when I first saw this idea, being a pediatrician, I thought of the analogy of Goldilocks. You know, why would we think that the people at Moderna know exactly how to make this in a way that it's not too hot, meaning not so much spike protein that it causes damage to the person that's getting the shot? And I would argue we are seeing that now. Not too cold, meaning how are they going to make just the right amount to initiate a good response? I think that this is not at all well thought out. So the spike protein is the pathologic piece. The virus itself is not the part that's causing the harm, and I would encourage everyone to listen to Dr. McCullough talk about this. He is a very well-credentialed cardiologist who is seeing the vascular damage that can happen. Basically, what we're finding out now, first of all, I don't know why anybody said that if you put a shot in somebody's arm, it just stays in the deltoid muscle. All the biology I ever learned talks about how we are networks, these very sophisticated networks of lymphatics and blood vessels. And we know that the gut talks to the brain and the brain talks to the gut and the endocrine system talks to the neurologic system. So why there was ever this mythology that we were going to inject this stuff and it was just going to stay there until we made an immune response and then magically disappear. But I'm very concerned. The study out of Harvard that shows that when they looked at 13 people that got the Moderna vaccine, 11 of them had the spike protein detectable in their blood for an average of 15 days. And in that 15 days, it is going, you know, everywhere blood goes, which is all through the body. We also know that the spike protein is accumulate. Now that we have the biodistribution data from Japan, we know that the spike proteins are accumulating in the spleen and the bone marrow and the liver and the adrenals. And I'm particularly concerned because that biodistribution study showed it's concentrating in very high amounts in the ovaries. So I'm very worried about these young people who are basically feeling like they have to trade getting the shot for the ability to go to college. I'm very concerned about its effect potentially on their fertility. And we've never rolled out a so-called vaccine in such wide distribution after such an incredibly short period of time of study. And there's going to be a meeting this Friday by the American Committee of Immunization Practices to look at the very concerning number of kids that are getting myocarditis, which is an inflammation of the heart muscle, or pericarditis, which is inflammation around of the sac around the heart. And they're going to make some decisions about whether to continue to go full speed ahead. So I plan to write to them and voice my concerns, and your listeners might want to think about doing that also. Remember, if you don't have a real risk from the disease itself, and in young people, the risk of mortality is vanishingly small. It's even according to the CDC, it's 0.0005% risk of mortality. Then if you're taking, you know, some kind of treatment, it can't have even, you know, so-called rare fatal side effects. And I'm concerned that that's what's happening. And this issue of the spike protein and how we are now, once we receive the vaccine, we make this pathogenic protein that can affect multiple organs. I really want us to use the precautionary principle. First, do no harm. You know, that's what we as physicians are supposed to do. It's nice if you can help people, but we shouldn't actually be hurting them. And I think that the way this vaccine has rolled out, we are hurting people.
I would agree. The evidence is there. Already we have more deaths confirmed by the government at the minimal accuracy level than all other vaccines combined in the last 30 years. That should have said, let us stop and do our homework before we use the American public as human guinea pigs. Thank you very much for being on. Yes.
Yeah. I was just going to say the VAERS report that you're referring to, when we bring that up, we're often criticized and like, well, anybody can report that. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's an association. But the reality is that, first, it's an incredible undercount. But secondly, we should be really investigating those reports. And I've been reporting to VAERS for over 30 years, and I've never gotten any kind of a callback or true investigation. So people will say it might be a coincidence. If that were true, it wouldn't show a temporal relationship. And there have been some papers published showing that the spike in those deaths tends to occur in the first 24 hours, the first 48 hours, or in people who develop their symptoms right after the shot. So if you look at that critically and scientifically, there is merit to those reports. And why the lay press is trying to just, you know, seemingly dismiss that as not important information is a mystery to me.
Well, I appreciate the efforts you're making to inform the larger medical community, your specific guild of pediatricians, and the parents out there. Thank you very much, Dr. Elizabeth Mumper. We appreciate your efforts.
Thank you, Gary.
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. A short commentary. For those who are frustrated by what you see as the effort to tear everything down, to tear all of our progress, all of our efforts, all the enormous achievements of people from all walks of life down, and to castigate one group and to put people against each other, shouldn't we have a pause and think a little deeper? And by the way, in my last comment, I mentioned there were 10 million children, 5 million with learning disabilities and also autoimmune conditions, and 5 million with autistic spectrum. But then you have to add in their parents to get the higher number. That's where that figure came from. It would seem that the woke generation's efforts to grasp authority, to cancel large swaths of our historical culture, is in full motion. Naively sensitive to being deeply offended as parents and adults and teens and children, we're told not to change a baby's diapers without its permission. It is offensive to cuddle with your partner in the middle of the night without their permission. Otherwise, we have crossed the red line and violated the privacy of their personal space, whatever that actually means in reality. The wokes are redefining couture fashion. We can only wear a sari or a kurta if we are Indian, or dress in Spanish, African or Asian fashion if it is our ethnic background. We're not supposed to eat in a Japanese, Mexican, or French restaurant unless it is our genetic inheritance. Otherwise, we are appropriating a culture that does not belong to us. Shame on us. We should not train in opera to sing like Enrico Caruso unless we are Italian, or Aretha Franklin unless we are black. Today, identity is being solely defined as the race or group we belong to. Individually, we don't count. In fact, all individuality is moot. Only the group and the group think counts. This may sound extreme, but it might only be the beginning of what the woke movement's politicized and weaponized rhetoric portends to a society's history and identity. We can look back at the great minds and authors of history for examples of past efforts to cancel those who are unafraid to think outside of the box and to perceive reality in ways others dare not to venture. They all have something in common. They, too, were ostracized and criticized by those who wanted to cancel them. I would draw an association that modern secular cancel culture is simply a snapshot of historical evangelical Christian moralism that was largely responsible for banning of books and authors in the past. And you do not have to be a Christian evangelical or a believer to become swept up in the self-righteous moralism and the ultimate moral authority over all things and all people. all events. Similarly, modern scientific materialism, which describes itself as liberal, has its direct origins in the Protestant Enlightenment mindset. Descartes, Francis Bacon, Newton, John Locke, Immanuel Kant, Galileo, Pasteur, James Clerk Maxwell, Darwin, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Hobbes, Pascal, and many others. They all followed a Christian pursuit to find the workings of God or providence outside of themselves in nature. None of them mastered deep introspection into the psyche. You've all heard, "I think, therefore I am." Well, that's just a childish, supercilious, adolescent, and extremely naive construct from an Eastern perspective. There was really very little cancellation or banning of most of the Age of Reason thinkers, except by religious authorities, either Catholic or Protestant. In general, the latter Age of Reason thinkers were not criticized by authorities for their science discoveries, but for their personal stance on religious matters. Fundamentally, the pursuit of so-called science was completely in keeping with the Weltanschauung of the mainstream churches at the time that all advocated for discovering the laws in the universe and nature because they believed that that law told them something about the mind of God. I'll give you examples. Probably the most famous, Socrates. Yes, they censored him. Michelangelo's Last Judgment painting in the Sistine Chapel, which I've seen, I'm sure many of you have, it was considered sinful. Galileo, the first to empirically observe that we live in a solar-centric system, challenged by the church. Michael Servetus, doctor, who discovered pulmonary circulation and applied the idea to theology and its understanding, he was burned at the stake upon orders from John Calvin. The dominant puritanical communities in the United States tried to cancel Thomas Paine, author Alexander Pope, Thomas Hobbes, John Locke, and the French philosophers of reason like Voltaire and Rousseau. In France, Rousseau was forced into exile in Switzerland, despite later the French educational system being based on his Rousseau's philosophy. So first you destroy the person, then you use his inspired insight. Efforts to cancel Spinoza by his own Orthodox Jewish community. Why? Because he had a different view of God. Thomas Paine and Ethan Allen's writings were pillared and banned by the then Christian right in colonies. U.S. Congress tried to cancel Thomas Jefferson because of his enormous library. Why? Because he had volumes of books challenging the Bible. Gregor Mendel, who first pioneered genetics, they tried to cancel him because of the concept of laws of inheritance. The efforts were made to ban Darwin's Origin of the Species. The state of Kansas in 1999 banned any reference to Darwin in schools. But like the vast majority of the great thinkers of the Age of Reason, Darwin still believed God was the ultimate lawmaker and the first cause of existence. Many, like Newton, were also theologians. Now, it is the liberal states banning any mention of creation science, despite its rather shaky principles it bases itself on. One of America's greatest 19th century thinkers, the psychologist William James, was canceled by the emergence of James Watson's behavioralism nonsense, purely nonsense. If psychology had followed James's principles of psychology, we may likely be actually curing people of mental disorders rather than relying upon drugs, because, like the Buddha, William James' psychological science was based upon subjective introspection. Nazis banned Einstein and removed his post in Berlin because he was a non-practicing Jew. Modern neuroscience has canceled the value of any personal subjective experience because you cannot find the mind under a microscope or any instrumentation to observe mental and conscious phenomena. So what they do not understand, do not have the intellectual capacity to conceive, they simply trash. Today's scientific materialists under the skeptic banner are canceling everyone who advocates for alternative and natural health. If you criticize vaccines, criticize COVID, criticize GMOs, criticize medicine, then you are pillared on Wikipedia. Very troubling are the books that the new radical culturalists have banned. To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by Mark Twain, Of Mice and Men by John Steinbeck, The K by Theodore Taylor, Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry by Mildred Taylor, The Odyssey by Homer, the Harry Potter books, The Color Purple, Alice Walker, Beloved by Toni Morrison. Yes, Toni Morrison's being canceled. The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown. But take us back to more classical books banned in America's past. Catcher in the Rye, J.D. Salinger, Animal Farm, George Orwell, Slaughterhouse-Five, Kurt Vonnegut, Canterbury Tales by Chaucer, Fanny Hill by John Cleland, Howl by Allen Ginsberg, Ulysses by James Joyce, Candide by Voltaire, Later Childe's Lover, D.H. Lawrence, Tropic of Cancer, Henry Miller, Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck, Catch-22, Joseph Heller, Moll Flanders, Daniel Defoe, Fahrenheit 451, Ray Bradbury, and Lolita, Vladimir Nabokov. How about the children's book recently banned? Six Dr. Seuss books, Curious George, Captain Underpants, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and children's books banned by some libraries and schools in the past, The Wizard of Oz by Frank Baum, Alice in Wonderland, Lewis Carroll, Charlotte's Web, Stuart Little, Winnie the Pooh in the UK, which was said that Piglet was offensive to Muslims. How about canceling historical statues? Abraham Lincoln, ordered by the Boston Art Commission. George Washington statue, Manhattan, Oregon, and New Orleans. Andrew Jackson in D.C. Jackson was, in my opinion, a jerk. Ulysses Grant in the Golden State Park. Francis Drake in Golden State Park. Francis Scott Keyes in California, Thomas Jefferson in Oregon, Virginia, the Virgin Mary in Massachusetts, Hiawatha in Wisconsin's La Crosse Park, and so it goes. At what point will we stop long enough to consider what we are seeing is a self-righteous purge of that which these individuals surely do not understand? What happens when you believe that we do not exist as individuals of unique being to contribute to the larger society, but we only exist as a clan, a group, a tribe, them against us? Now let's go to one of those people who was canceled repeatedly in his own time. I'll do the other commentary tomorrow. And this is about one of the greatest minds in history. Someone that we should pay careful attention to his work, because a lot of what you use today came from him, Nikola Tesla.
On the 7th of January, 1943, a maid working at the New Yorker Hotel entered room 3327, where one of their permanent residents was staying. Inside, she found the body of an 86-year-old man, who had died alone in a room he had been living in for the last 9 years of his life. The man was broke, and had been living on a diet of milk and crackers, using the little resources he had left to feed and take care of the local pigeons. This man went by the name of Nikola Tesla. Seeing Tesla in his final years, it would have been hard to believe he was one of the greatest minds of the modern era. His genius shaped the world we know today, pioneering the alternating current, the electrical system which powers our homes around the globe. His influence can be seen all around us, from remote control and radio to wireless communication. Perhaps most impressive of all, Tesla's work and creations came out of his passion for science, with his earnings being sunk into projects aimed at the betterment of humanity, rather than for greed and profit. Tesla was born on the 10th of July, 1856, in modern-day Croatia. His mother came from a line of inventors, and had an incredible memory, being able to memorize the entirety of Serbian epic poems, and so she trained her son with exercises in memorization. As time went on, Tesla was known to have an eidetic memory, later speaking 8 different languages, which he credited to his mother's efforts in his youth. At the age of 5, Tesla witnessed the death of his older brother in a horse riding accident, the image of which would stay with him for his entire life. After this, Tesla began experiencing flashes of light and images, making it hard to separate reality from his imagination. He claimed his inventions would come to him in these flashes of light, conceptualizing their entire design in his head and correcting their flaws without ever putting pen to paper. In an interview from 1919, he described this process, stating, "I do not rush into actual work. When I get an idea, I start at once building it up in my imagination. I change the construction, make improvements, and operate the device in my mind. It is absolutely immaterial to me whether I run my turbine in thought or test it in my shop. Invariably, my device works as I conceived that it should, and the experiment comes out exactly as I planned it. In 20 years, there has not been a single exception." Tesla excelled in the education system, but ended up dropping out of university due to a gambling addiction and other personal issues. Inspired by electrical demonstrations by his physics professor, Tesla went and got a job with the Paris branch of the Continental Edison Company in 1882, installing indoor lighting around the city. Management soon realized that his talents were wasted on such a job, and tasked him with constructing and improving dynamos and motors. He was so insightful in his innovations that the company soon had him traveling around Europe, fixing problems at other Edison installations. In 1884, at the age of 28, Tesla's manager offered him a job at Edison Machine Works in New York City, an offer he accepted. He soon moved to America, where he would spend a majority of his life, becoming a naturalized citizen 7 years later in 1891. He soon came into contact with company owner Thomas Edison, and the two initially got on, with Tesla describing Edison as an inspirational figure.
We'll come right back to it. I just want to say goodbye to our WBAI audience. You're going to be cutting away now for the news. Everyone else can continue to hear this right up to the end of the program on PRN.FM.
Any hard-working assistants, but do you take the cake? This mutual admiration would not last long, however, with a lifelong rivalry soon developing. The main source of animosity between the two resulted from a disagreement about the type of current each man preferred. Edison's company owned the patents for DC, or direct current, a system where electric charge only flows in one direction. Tesla, however, was an advocate for alternating current, or AC, a system where the electric charge changes direction periodically. These changes in direction allow AC currents to maintain power over longer distances. It is also possible to use devices called transformers to change the magnitude of AC voltage, allowing a current to travel at a high voltage and then be reduced to a lower voltage for safe use in homes. Tesla tried explaining the benefits of alternating current to Edison, but Edison wouldn't listen, as it could ruin the sales for direct current, to which he owned all the patents. Edison then offered Tesla a large bonus of $50,000 if he redesigned 24 of his obsolete machines. Upon completion, Edison refused to pay, and revealed that the task had been a practical joke, saying, "Tesla, you don't understand our American humor." Tesla resigned after 6 months at the company, and set out on his own. He wanted to change the world, and he knew he could. He spent the next year setting up his own company, developing his ideas on alternating current. However, his investors showed little interest and decided to take the company, including all the patents he created. He was left digging ditches in the street to survive. Fortunes would soon change for Tesla, however, with his ideas on an alternating current motor catching the eye of a new investor, helping establish the Tesla Electric Company in 1887. He then designed a motor which was much cheaper and easier to maintain than the ones using a direct current. He revealed his motor at the American Institute of Electrical Engineers the following year, a display that caught the attention of a businessman named George Westinghouse. Westinghouse was a major player in the electric market and needed Tesla's motor to complete his alternating current system, a system that would compete against Thomas Edison. Westinghouse bought the motor and hired Tesla as a consultant for the equivalent of $55,000 a month, along with royalties for each horsepower produced by his motors. Things for Tesla were looking good. And so began the war of the currents. Edison started going to extreme lengths to discredit Tesla's AC system. He began paying schoolchildren 25 cents to bring him household pets, where he would set up a public stage and electrocute the animals, in an attempt to show the public that Tesla's AC system was not safe. Over time, electrocutions increased in scale, with a horse eventually being executed in public. Edison continued executing animals many years after the War of the Currents had concluded, with the Edison Film Company producing a short film in 1903 titled Electrocuting an Elephant. The film showed the electrocution of Topsy, a former circus elephant who was killed when 6,600 volts were shot through her body. Despite the negative press generated by Edison, Tesla and Westinghouse continued to develop their alternating current system. The opportunity to show that alternating current was both safe and viable for large-scale use came at the World's Columbian Exposition, hosted in Chicago in 1893. Edison had put forward an offer to light the fair, but Westinghouse underbid him, winning the contract and with it the chance to outshine Edison. While it was a struggle to provide lighting at the low cost put forward, Westinghouse and Tesla succeeded, showing the world the strength of alternating current. Their success continued, with Westinghouse Electric being chosen over Edison's company, General Electric, to construct a hydroelectric plant at Niagara Falls. Tesla drew up designs for the plant, which was a massive success, eventually powering part of New York City. Alternating current continued to grow in popularity and became the system we all use to power our homes today, with direct current being phased out over the next decade. While Westinghouse won the War of the Currents, his company was left on the verge of bankruptcy, with $10 million of debt. He turned to Tesla for help, asking him to temporarily reduce his royalties to help him keep his company afloat. Compelled by compassion for his friend, instead of reducing his royalties, Tesla tore up his contract, eliminating them entirely. The money he gave up would be worth $300 million in today's money, but this was of little concern to Tesla, who was more interested in the pursuit of science over financial gain. This act saved Westinghouse, who would go on to buy Tesla's AC patent for $216,000 in 1897. This is equivalent to about $6 million today, money that Tesla used to set up new laboratories in New York and fully dedicate himself to invention.
There is more to this than you can complete watching it. By the way, Tesla was an extraordinarily generous person, and the United States government stole his ideas, and yet Westinghouse went ahead and paid his rent out of an obligation, a more obligation, because he knew that they had benefited by billions of dollars, and here he was living on milk and crackers, one of the greatest minds in history. And that's just the beginning. He was the first, not Marconi. Marconi was not the first to invent the radio. It was Tesla. But his factory burned down in a mysterious fire, and it took him 2 years to redo it. And by the time he finished it, Marconi had filed a patent on it, and Edison supported Marconi. So Marconi got the credit. Marconi got a Nobel Prize, and nine of the patents that Tesla had, Marconi used in securing the technology for his radio. Tesla should have received multiple Nobel Prizes, and yet he was canceled in his own time by the cancel culture. Just a footnote to history for those who choose to look at it, see what lessons we can learn, and to at least abide by some sense of humility that there had been great minds before the current rageful cancel culture who contributed to the cancel culture's embitterment of life, with no sense of irony there. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. And by the way, I asked people to send in pictures, how they're looking, what they're doing over the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. since our first get-together in 1971 upstate at the healing at the upstate farm. And I just took some pictures 2 days ago, put them up on GaryNall.com, picking fruit in the morning. And you'll see all the different fruits. And by the way, interesting, isn't it? The lychee tree with thousands of lychees has been there 25 years, never produced a lychee. This year, boom, thousand lychees. And the cactus that I'm in front of, the cactus in 25 years grew 9 feet. In the last 6 months, it's grown 20 feet. Interesting. Have a nice day, everyone.